Oh, well, it's been such a joy to see many of you and families that are here together over the Thanksgiving. And if I can, on a personal note, I just want to mention that today is my wife and my 34th wedding anniversary. Kind of crazy on a Sunday, because with me preaching and she's teaching upstairs, I have not even seen her yet today. So when you go pick up your kids, tell her that her husband said happy anniversary and you'll get me some brownie points, okay? Want to just bring your attention real quick. This is such a rich time of the year with opportunities for outreach of neighbors and friends and to invite them to things. We've been talking about this, but next Saturday night is going to be the original of the drama play, A Star to Guide Me, put on by people here at Cedar Run, Cheryl DeWinter, and the team have been working on that diligently for months now, and it's going to be an incredible opportunity. This is for all ages. Bring your families, everything. We're going to just be in here together. So this is next Saturday night, 7 to 8 p.m., and then we'll have a little bit of dessert after. We'll also sing some carols together before we actually have the dramatic presentation, but just incredible opportunity. It's an original. I think there's 7 or 8. How many original songs, Lee, that have been written for this? And so hope you'll be there for that. Also, then the following Saturday, which would be December the, see if that's a second, well, anyway, December 9th. That wasn't that complicated, was it? We have the Christmas tea here. Great opportunity, ladies, for you to come together. And I believe this year we're going to have Megan Hermes, who's actually a pastor's wife. A pastor who is one of the chaplains, I think, with the Washington Redskins, is going to be here speaking about peace. And what a great opportunity to come and be at that tea. Today is the last day you can actually sign up here in the church. There's a sign-up table to the right. So please sign up if you're here and be at that. Bring someone. Every one of these things, whether it's the drama or whether it's the tea, bring someone with you to experience that and to hear the truth of who Jesus is this Christmas. You can actually sign up online, I think, through next Saturday, but they need to get their counts in to let the caterer know. We're actually catering it this year. So that's coming up. You've seen there's Christmas trees out there. Please buy yourself a Christmas tree if you can. And with that, so much for the public service announcements, and on with the message. So how was everyone's Thanksgiving, huh? Good? It's such a great time for people to gather around the table to share a meal together. I am curious, did anyone here, this year or any year, have to deal with any conflict over who would host your Thanksgiving feast? Anybody? See, particularly when children get married, there can be some tension over which set of in-laws the children would join with on this or other major holidays, Christmas, Easter. We are addressing this now with our kids, as both my sons are married, and their resolution to the we cannot be two places at once dilemma is 1 year they spend Thanksgiving with one set of in-laws and then Christmas with the other, and then they reverse it the next year. And we were blessed to have them both with us this Thanksgiving, and I'm blessed to have them here this morning. Well, this has been a great compromise. Now, Nadita and I, when we got married, we were faced with a challenge that made that type of compromise more difficult, because Nadita's mom was in her glory when she was in the kitchen cooking. And so she wanted us at her house for every Thanksgiving meal. Now, this could have created some conflict, except that my family was small. It was just my mom, my dad, and me. And since my mom was not used to cooking big Thanksgiving meals, whereas that was Nadita's mom's stock and trade, Nadita's mom invited my parents to join with us at her house. And over the next 27 years that both my parents were alive, we would all go to Nadita's mom's for Thanksgiving meal. It was a match made in heaven, because Nadita's mom loved to cook and my dad loved to eat. So it worked out perfect. But I must say that over the years, when we would raise the thought of perhaps that year having Thanksgiving at one of the children's homes, Nadita's or sister-in-law's, right, all the same people, just a different location, we would face great resistance from Nadita's mom. Why? Well, because she liked to cook, yes, but she also liked to be in control. Anybody else here have a relative that wants the major holiday meal to be at their home all the time? Well, before we become too critical of any of your relatives who might fit this profile, let me just say this. Before casting any stones, look in the mirror. Because deep down, we all have this desire to be in control. It may not be about controlling something as simple as getting to host a holiday meal, but deep down inside, we all want to be in charge. When we boil it down to its simplest expression, we all want to be God in our worlds. This is why one of the first principles a person must come to grips with in any addiction program, AA or otherwise, is to accept that they are not God. To accept that they are just finite, weak human being who cannot really control anything, not even their own desire, be it for alcohol or drugs or whatever might happen to be the focus of their addiction. So the healing process cannot begin until that person is willing to admit the simple truth, I am not God. I am not in control in my world. I cannot even control my own response to the impulses that tempt me to violate my own basic value system. And so I need help from a power far stronger than myself. And this I am not God way of living life is not limited to those with addictive impulses. Every single one of us struggles with it. The Apostle Paul addressed it in this classic passage found in the book of Romans. Romans 7, we're going to look at verses 15 and then 19 and 20. Let's read it again because this is so much the story, I think, of all our lives. I do not understand what I do. And where did this sin come from that Paul describes as the reason for a struggle? We'll just go back to the very first sin committed back in the Garden of Eden. What line did the serpent use to tempt Eve into disobeying God? Let's look at that in Genesis 3, verses 4 through 6. Oh, Eve, you will not surely die, the serpent said to the woman. For God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will actually be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. When the woman saw the fruit of the tree was good for food, pleasing to the eye, but also desirable for gaining wisdom, for being like God, she took some and she ate it. Eat this fruit and you will be what? Satan says, like God. You will be in control of your own world. You will be in charge. Life will be all about you, your happiness, your success. And from that moment on, the theme song to human existence became, it's all about me. Oh, we sing the worship song, it's all about you, Lord. But deep down, we were often thinking, it's all about me, Lord, really. My happiness, my success. And I need to be in control of making it happen. This is at the center of sin and many of the challenges we face in this world. This principle was expressed in a recent episode of the TV series. I think I explained a couple of weeks ago, has been a treasure trove of illustrations for me to use in my sermon messages. Anybody here remember the show I referred to that I use? Star Trek. Somebody did. Star Trek. Well, in this particular episode, a man who had been created through advanced eugenics to be like a Superman is attempting to take over the Enterprise. And after Captain Kirk outwits him and takes him into custody, he gives him this option. He can be sent to a barren planet, or he can remain with them under arrest. And the man's response is to quote from Milton in his famous poem, Paradise Lost, a quote that I found extremely applicable to my talk this morning. That quote is this: better to reign in hell than to serve in heaven. Better to reign in hell than to serve in heaven. Better to be God of my own world, no matter how miserable a world it is, than to serve God in his world, a world filled with beauty and wonder. So how can we overcome the destructive desire that is in all of us? Well, this morning we're going to look at a man from the Old Testament and how he learns his lesson. that he is not God, that he is not really in control of anything that matters. If you have Bibles, turn to the Old Testament book of 2 Kings. 2 Kings, the 5th chapter. And we're going to pick it up in verse 1. 2 Kings chapter 5, verse 1. Now Naaman was commander of the army of the king of Aram. He was a great man in the sight of his master and highly regarded because through him the Lord had given victory to Aram. He was a valiant soldier, but he had leprosy. Let's pause for a moment to reflect on what this fellow Naaman's mindset would have been. He is this great general who has just soundly defeated the armies of Israel. And he's like Douglas MacArthur or Dwight Eisenhower at the close of World War II, one of the most admired men in the world because of his military exploits. He returns home to Aram after the war with fame, influence, wealth, and power. Oh, yeah. One other thing he brought back from this war. There was an area of the skin that had become discolored. So this man who controlled an army, who held the power of life and death over about just anyone who might cross him, who has the power to impact just about any situation he might face, except for this one. Because this man now has leprosy. Now, this is a horrid disease. Once you were diagnosed with leprosy back then, it was essentially a death sentence. I mean, think of the most aggressive form of cancer today. But this was even worse, because a person with cancer is often surrounded by their loved ones. A person with leprosy was shunned and forced to live out their life alone so as not to infect anyone else. And this is what Naaman is now faced with. This man who had incredible power and wealth and the illusion of control all that brought him now is in a situation he has absolutely no control over. Well, now Naaman brought something else back from the war with him. Let's pick this up in verse 2. Verse 2. Now bands from Aram had gone out and had taken captive a young girl from Israel, and she served Naaman's wife. She said to her mistress, "If only my master would see the prophet who is in Samaria, he would cure him of his leprosy." Now, think on this one. This slave girl had seen her family and friends murdered and taken into captivity by the army led by this man. Now, if that were me, I would probably be thinking, it serves him right. But not this girl. This young girl who is at the bottom rung of the power scale now holds the future of this man at the top rung of the power scale in her hands. And well, she's a better person than me because she tells Naaman's wife of a way for him to be cured through this prophet in Israel. Now, of course, if I'm Naaman, I'm thinking, why would this prophet want to help me? I mean, this is like near the end of World War II, Adolf Hitler asking Joseph Stalin, were there any good doctors in Moscow? I mean, it's a crazy idea. But Naaman does not have a lot of other options. So he goes, picking it up in verse 4. Naaman went to his master and told him what the girl from Israel had said. "By all means, go," the king of Aram replied. "I will send a letter to the king of Israel." So Naaman left, taking with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 sets of clothing. The letter that he took to the king of Israel read, "With this letter I am sending my servant Naaman to you, king, so that you may cure him of his leprosy." Naaman's king says, "Okay, I'll send the king a letter on your behalf." Now, this king of Aram understands nothing about Elisha or the God he serves. He just figures king to king, that's the way we get things done, you know? So if there's some magic power this Elisha fella has to heal leprosy, I'll just have his king direct Elisha to sprinkle it on Naaman. You know, I'll deal ruler to ruler and we'll get this done. Naaman takes this letter from his king to Israel's king. And with it, Naaman brings a load of gold, silver, and clothes. He wants to make sure the king is properly inclined to motivate this Elisha guy to apply his magic healing potion. Can you see Naaman's mindset here? I'm a wealthy man. I'll buy my way to getting healed. Verse 7. As soon as the king of Israel read the letter, he tore his robes and said, "Am I God? Can I kill and bring back to life? Why does this fellow send someone to me to be cured of his leprosy? See how he's trying to pick a quarrel with me?" Yeah, the king of Israel's scared because he gets it. He's not in control of getting Naaman cured. And so he fears it's just a pretense for Naaman's king to further subjugate and plunder his kingdom. This is why he tears his robes. Because in the Old Testament, the tearing of one's robes was a sign of being in great anguish. Verse 8. When Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his robes, word spread, he sent him this message. "Why have you torn your robes? Have the man come to me, and he will know that there is a prophet in Israel." So Naaman went with his horses and chariots and stopped at the door of Elisha's house. Elisha sent a messenger to say to him, "Go wash yourself 7 times in the Jordan, and your flesh will be restored, and you will be cleansed." Elisha hears of it, says, "Send him to me." Naaman shows up at Elisha's house with his impressive entourage, right? But what is Naaman's not so subtle message to Elisha here? "Elisha, this is your lucky day. Look at me, look at my power. And you are going to be privileged to get to heal me. I mean, this will probably make your career, Elisha, as a healing superstar. You'll be all over YouTube after healing me." Naaman probably expects Elisha to eagerly come running out of his house to perform his healing magic. But that's not what happens, is it? Elisha does not come out at all. Rather, he sends a messenger, one of his kids perhaps, one of his servants, with a simple command: "Go wash yourself in the Jordan River." And Naaman, the man who is always in control, with people rushing to meet his every need, now God still has some teaching to do. Still has some things for him to learn about who is really in control. Just look at verses 11 and 12. But Naaman went away angry, said, "I thought that it would surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God, wave his hand over the spot and cure me of my leprosy. Are not Abana and Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than any of the waters of Israel? Couldn't I wash in them and be cleansed?" He turned and went off in a rage. Naaman is thinking, who is this Elisha? And what kind of puny God does he follow? See, Naaman was expecting something out of a Steven Spielberg movie, right? And all he gets is, "Go dunk yourself in the Jordan River." If that's all it took, Naaman thinks, I could have done that back in my homeland in one of its rivers. And so he leaves in anger. Why? He's still not in control. And he still cannot accept it. He would rather die than be unable to control the method of his healing. Oh, he may not be thinking that intellectually, but it is where he's headed. Because his need to be in control is so strong. And his servants see what he cannot see. Verse 13. Naaman's servants went to him and said, "Father, if the prophet had told you to do some great thing, would you not have done it? How much more when he tells you, how much more then when he tells you, wash and be cleansed?" Think about this. So many contradictions in the story. Who are the wise ones in this story? Is it the kings and the powerful? No, it's a slave girl and a bunch of servants. They are the ones that understand what it is like to have to rely on someone bigger than themselves. Reminds me of the words Jesus would one day speak, of the first being last and the last being first. Those who seem so insignificant in the conventional wisdom of the time are actually those who have the greatest impact in God's world. So the servants say to Naaman, "So what if this God is not making you have to show your greatness in order to be healed? So what if all he is asking you to do is to show faith in him by obeying the simple command he gives you? Should you not do it if it'll heal you?" I thought of how, in a way, this provides a picture of how people struggle today with God's simple command of how to be healed of our spiritual sickness. See, friends, we are all infected by sin. We're all separated by God because of it. And God says to us, all we have to do to be healed is to obey His simple command to trust in Jesus' death on the cross to pay the penalty for our sin, and we will be healed spiritually. It's not just me. Here's a couple verses that say this. Romans 10, 9 and 10. That if you confess with your mouth Jesus is Lord, and you believe in your heart that God raised Him from the dead, you will be saved. And then 1 John 5, 11 and 12. And this is the testimony. God has given us eternal life. And this life is in His Son, Jesus. He who has the Son, who has Jesus, has life. He who does not have the Son does not have life. So God says to us throughout the pages of the Bible, trust in Jesus and you will be healed and forgiven and assured of a place with me in heaven for all eternity. And people say, nah, that's too simple. There must be more to it. I must have to do something bigger than that. That's too easy. Yes, friends, it's simple, but it is not easy. It is not easy for us selfish, need-to-be-in-control human beings to humble ourselves and accept we cannot control our eternal destiny by what we do. But we must simply trust in what God did in sending His Son Jesus to die. It is a simple act to trust in what God did, but it is not an easy one because we do not want to give up control and to rely totally on someone else, even if it is God. Well, Naaman's problem was he wanted to be in control, and God just wanted him to trust Him, to surrender to Him, to give up control to Him. And I wonder how long Naaman struggled with the issue of pride and self-sufficiency and control versus trust and surrender and obedience. In the end, there still is that little discolored patch of skin that Naaman realizes he cannot fix on his own, no matter how hard he tries. So he finally realizes that he must surrender his pride and say, yes, God. I wonder if the thought crossed Naaman's mind, how incredibly gracious this God must be. Naaman had shown no interest in him, had subjugated his people, and yet God is still willing to heal me? Well, something now happens in Naaman that had never occurred before. He surrenders to God. Verse 14. So he went down and dipped himself in the Jordan 7 times as the man of God had told him. And his flesh was restored and became clean like that of a young boy. Picture it. Naaman traveling down to the Jordan River, taking off all his royal armor and jumping into the water and bobbing up and down 7 times as God had instructed. And the healing takes place. The leprosy goes away. And then verse 15, the last verse we'll look at. Then Naaman and all his attendants went back to the man of God. He stood before him and said, now I know that there is no God in all the world except in Israel. Please accept now a gift from your servant. Naaman has learned that there is a God and what it means to surrender and trust completely in that God. To allow that God to be in control. See, my friends, we all will come face to face one day with our own little patch of discolored skin. Something that will make it so clear we cannot fix it on our own. We cannot control its outcome. Wouldn't it be nice to turn to that unlimited God who is in control when that time comes? B.J. Thomas was a man that learned this. He had received wealth and fame as a singer with hits like the multi-million selling song, Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head. Anybody remember what movie that was in? What was it? Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid. But with his fame and wealth came a dependency on drugs and alcohol that B.J. Thomas could not control. It was about to cost him all his wealth and fame. It was about to cost him his family, a beautiful wife and 3 daughters. It was about to cost him his very life. because he was very close to overdosing when he surrendered control of his life to Christ. He would, a few years later, write a song that I listened to as a new Christian. I'd listen to this over and over again. Its title was, "He's Got It All in Control." It goes like this. He holds the stars in the sky. He holds the land back from the sea. If he can do all of that, surely he can take care of you and me. This was the attitude of the slave girl who directed Naaman to Elisha. That's what she had. She viewed the world through this lens of, I've got this great big God in heaven. And he is so great that watching over this planet I exist on is no big deal for him. And this great big God cares about me. Oh, I may not be God, but I am one of his children. Therefore, it matters not if I am a slave girl or one of the most powerful people on the planet, because I have a God who is walking with me daily. And he knows and he cares. I am not here all on my own. And it's because she knew this that she was able to show, I believe, such grace to Naaman. This girl's heart was filled with humility instead of pride, with a sense of the sufficiency of God that gave her confidence rather than anxiety about her future. You see, when I live as though I am not in control, that I am not God, but I am his child, then I can stop worrying. I mean, when an anxious thought about the future comes into my mind, well, since I am not God, I can just give it over to Jesus, who is God. I don't have to feel the weight of the world on my shoulders because it is Jesus who is holding the world up. I want to close with one last person, someone I knew very well who learned Naaman's lesson and gave up control. Talked about this before, but this person was my dad. He had grown up the very embodiment of self-sufficiency because his father left his mom, my grandmother, right before he was born. His mom had to move to D.C. to find work, and so he was brought up in a home in Lynchburg, Virginia, by two aunts who worked full-time. So he had to fend for himself from a very young age. He graduated from high school in 1942 and went right off to war. He would tell me how the day after graduating high school, he was on a train to Michigan for basic training, and then off to the Pacific, where he served as a gunnery mate on a ship, until finally returning home in 1946, 4 years after leaving it. When I went off to college, my dad made no preparations for me to come home until Christmas break. And I used to call him all the time, whining about getting me a plane ticket home because I was homesick. Looking back, I think, is it any wonder that whining fell on deaf ears? I mean, I was 300 miles from home for 3 months. He had been 3,000 miles from home for 4 years. My dad was from what has been referred to as the greatest generation, a generation of men in particular, who because of the war had to grow up fast and learn to take care of themselves and to be in control. And that was my dad. That's how he lived his life. Even when the love of his life, my mom, began to exhibit signs of dementia and began to require constant care, my dad made it clear to us, I got it. I've got it. It's not your worry. Then he collapsed one night at dinner, was rushed to the hospital, and would never return home to my mom. Sorry. We would take her to visit him every day. But he knew he was dying. And perhaps for the first time in his 85 years on this earth, he realized he was not God. He was not in control. And so my dad, who had for the 34 years since I had placed my faith in Christ and tried to share it with him, his need for Christ, who had always very politely but firmly replied, "David, no thank you. I've got it under control." On the very last day before he would lose consciousness, it was just him and me. He started pointing his finger up at the sky. When I said, "Dad, do you want to pray to receive Jesus?" He nodded, "Yes." And he prayed. It was a simple prayer, but one that had taken 85 years to be willing to let go and pray. And in that moment, he gave up control of his life to Jesus Christ. And because of that, when he left this world 2 days later, he left it not under the false delusion that he was a God in control, but under the magnificent reality that he was a child of the most infinite high God who had always been and always will be in control. And let me tell you, never has a saying "better late than never" meant more to me. So how about you? There is no need to wait to take the steps taken by Naaman and B.J. Thomas and my dad and countless others over the last 2,000 years, and to give up control by surrendering yourself to Jesus. Worship team is going to come forward now as I pray. Precious Lord, it is so hard. We all want to be in control. It's just part of us. Lord, letting go, giving up control, trusting in you. Father, maybe it's one of the most difficult things we have to do. And yet, Lord, you're there. You're faithful. You always come through. Oh, maybe not exactly always the way we thought, always the exact way we wanted, but you do come through. And ultimately, you come through by taking us to heaven to be with you in joy and bliss for all eternity when we leave this world. So, Lord, at this time of thanksgiving, Lord, we're now going to sing. We're going to sing about giving thanks to you, the God who made it possible for us to let go and to give everything over to you and to know that you will take care of us. In Jesus' name, amen.